Welcome to It's Our Money with Ellen Brown, a look behind the curtain of global finance and monetary control with one of the top experts in the field. Author of the bestseller Web of Debt and the Public Bank Solution, Ellen Brown's pioneering research started the national movement to create new American public banks. We'll look at developments in the banking industry, economics, and money itself, and we'll update you on developments on the public banking frontier. Our program is underwritten by Payment Management Merchant Credit Card Services at paymentmgmt.com.
The solution to all of it is a life capital understanding and application so that life capital is protected rather than destroyed. And you begin with public banking as, I think, the ultimate necessary basis of any working economy. And I would even argue that the only economy that works is one that does have public banking or the equivalent to public banking. So you have to have a life capital criterion. Are they producing a life good without which life will be destroyed, degrees or all at once? If they're not producing a life good, then we're not going to invest in it. So once you get the public bank idea that it's public money that is the real basis of having an economy that is healthy, and then we have a criterion of all public investment. So it rules out armaments and all kinds of things. If the public investment isn't in life capital, such as education, life capital, such as healthcare, life capital, such as our sidewalks and means of communication, and on you go. It includes everything that's worthwhile. But if it isn't for that, then it shouldn't happen. That should be the criterion of it. You're investing in life.
That's our guest today, University professor and author John McMurtry of Canada's Guelph University, describing the true nature of economic capital, life itself, in all its forms. His macro diagnosis of our economic vitality is that we have a metastasizing cancer that, as economist Michael Hudson describes it, is killing the host. Hello, and welcome once again to It's Our Money with Ellen Brown. I'm Walt McCree, chair of the Public Banking Institute and Ellen's colleague in the work of shining a light on the nature of our money and its related systems in order to reveal how we the people must move the body politic toward new priorities, new choices, new systems committed to the public interest. Dr. McMurtry will be along later in the program to discuss the elements of his book called The Cancer Stage of Capitalism. You know, I'd like to acknowledge you, our loyal listeners, for having the intellectual curiosity and interest to dig into some of the theoretical thinking that we offer you, since not many people recognize or even want to know the importance of what's behind that curtain of monetary control, the economic developments that we all see, and their partnering cultural drivers. While at times this may not be the easiest of listening, once you get a sense of where the wind is blowing from that drives our future, it's hard to not be fascinated and perhaps not infrequently upset about this journey of civilization. But if you've made it this far as a listener, you're probably one of those people for whom actively questioning what the heck's going on around us, who's doing it, what's the plan, and where are we going, you're probably also a thought leader and someone who wants to participate in shaping the evolutionary process that we find ourselves in. So congratulations and thank you for being in this conversation with us about our money. As we offer you some perspectives on money-related social and economic concerns, we're pleased today to deliver our first interview from the Public Banking Institute's What Wall Street Costs America project, as Matt Standard interviews a leading journalist in Birmingham about how Wall Street trickery laid waste to civic life, assets, and prospects in Jefferson County, Alabama. What Wall Street Costs America is also a chance for you to tell your story about how those impacts have affected you and your community. And this week, Ellen did a new article, a bit of a little study comparison piece, about how a public bank, like that in North Dakota, could powerfully affect one of the largest economies in the world, the state of California. A perfect example of the impact that a public interest bank can have on the economy of a governmental body. I ask her what drove her to do this exercise.
So the Bank of North Dakota just came out with their 2015 annual report in which they announced record profits. They've had record profits every year for the last 12 years, each year better than the last. And this is in spite of the fact that for the last 2 years, oil has plummeted. North Dakota should be really struggling, like some other oil states. And, you know, you saw that different people would say, you'd see different articles that would said, oh, they're going down now because oil's going down, and it was all about oil, so they said. But North Dakota has not gone down. It's doing quite well, thank you very much. They're switching over into other sorts of products that they're developing. And in some ways, the oil boom was a big stress on the economy because they had to put a lot of money into roads and infrastructure in order to keep the roads adequate for the farmers because those big oil rigs were ruining them. So the heat's kind of off now, and they can settle into being farmers and the other things that they used to do. So anyway, this report said that the Bank of North Dakota reported net earnings of $130 million for the year. I mean, way up there. We're talking about a state of 670,000 people, last time I looked, compared to, for example, in California, where I am, 34 million people. So there's 50 times as many people in California as there are in North Dakota. So we're talking about virtually the smallest state versus the biggest state, virtually the biggest state. So just think what California could do with an equivalent sort of bank. And California has a lot of assets that they could use, that they could transfer into this bank, a lot of money that they could transfer over for deposits. Mm-hmm. So, also they reported a return on investment of 18.1%.
Wow.
So they're keeping that up as well. So they're doing really well. And they're, one thing, notable thing they're doing is building schools. You know, in California, we're stuck with these capital appreciation bonds where over the course of 20 or 30 or 40 years, whatever they are, they'll be paying $15 for every dollar borrowed.
Wow.
In other words, 15 times what they
borrow. Wow.
So they're
unbelievable.
Really,
Wall Street costs America, right?
Exactly. I mean, that's probably the worst, one of the worst. I mean, it's like payday loans for a school district because they don't have any other choice. Well, in North Dakota, they can go to the Bank of North Dakota, and I saw that in December 2014, they built one school at 1% interest. That was the interest rate. Mm-hmm. But I know they did at least one in December 2014. This was after oil had crashed, and you would have expected the economy was crashing. They're making 1% loans to a school district to build a school. So that would be great. That would be great for California. So I just wrote up, because we're at the stage where a lot of people are convinced it's a good idea, but now we're at the nuts and bolts stage. Like, how do we do it? What's it going to cost us? What do we have to put up to get started? What can we expect to make off it? What are the risks? That sort of thing. So I thought I would write an article on that, particularly about California, because that's my state, and it's got
Well, one of the things that you pointed out was how much money the state has got parked in a variety of accounts that are getting, and like billions, tens of billions of dollars, getting less than 0.5% of interest.
Right. In that, just in the Treasurer's investment pool, or the, I think it's called the pooled money investment account, there are $67.7 billion earning under 0.5% interest.
And so if they had that in a public bank,
they could pay them the same. They could pay them 0.5% interest on that, on their deposits. So they're not going to lose anything on that money. They're just shifting it over from, a lot of it is in banks now, but mostly it's in treasuries. I think about half of it is in U.S. treasuries, like short-term, you know, making 0.5% interest. What I was writing about as a model would be, what if you put up $1 billion, which you could get out of the pension funds? They're always looking for good investments. And California's pension funds together, the CalPERS and CalSTRS together, the two biggest pension funds in the country, have $500 billion in it, like half a billion dollars. So $1 billion, they wouldn't even notice, you know, if they put that in, and they want a 7% return. So let's say you give them a 7% return over 20 years. And just to show what you could save, and that's just for a hypothetical, I wrote that $1 billion would be enough to back $10 billion in assets, in loans. So let's say you pulled $11 billion out of the Treasury's investment pool and put it into your bank as deposits, and then you have your $1 billion in capital that you got from the pension funds. So then you could take $1 billion of your $11 billion, hold that back as reserves, make it $11.1 billion, so 10% would be $1.1 billion, hold that back as reserves, and then you've got $10 billion that you can lend or invest. So let's say you took that $10 billion in 2008, I think, the voters approved the $10 billion on the bullet train from Los Angeles to San Francisco, which is very controversial, and everybody says it's going to be outrageously expensive. Well, one of its big expenses is that by the time bond issue is paid off, this is just on the initial $10 billion outlay, they're going to pay another $9.5 billion in interest.
Wow.
So let's say you took your $10 billion and just bought back that whole bond issue, refinanced it through your own bank, and or just bought it back, then you would save $9.5 billion over 20 years, what you were going to pay in interest.
And then, of course, that would generate some profits, too, wouldn't it, for the bank?
Yeah, so you'd save the $9.5 billion. Of that, you'd have to pay the 0.5% interest, over, let's say it was over 20 years. You'd be left with about $5.5 billion in profits after deducting the cost of funds.
Wow.
So that's all profit. You can either use part of that, you can just pay back the capital outlay from the pension fund, pay them their $1 billion back, then you've got your own capital and to do with as you will, and you don't have to worry about losing anybody else's money.
Mm-hmm.
So you could have $4.5 billion in capital to capitalize now another $40 billion in loans, which you could, you know, backed by deposits that you could pull out of the Treasury's investment pool again.
Right.
But that is probably not what they would use the money for. That was just a hypothetical to show how much you could save without going to any trouble at all.
Yeah, California has been in the red for many, many years, now recently emerging from the red. The state has got $1 billion in surplus at this point.
Yes, but then they're setting aside money for rainy day funds and stuff. So you could save a lot more than that.
Yeah. Well, what do you need to make this happen, Ellen?
We need the political will. So that's
there you
the point
go.
Of writing about it, is to show what a no-brainer this is. Why don't we do it? But
yeah.
there are other things you could do, too. Once you get your bank set up, one idea that I like is to do something like the Reconstruction Finance Corporation during the Depression, where they basically were just acting as intermediary, where they would make loans.
Mm-hmm.
The way all banks do, you know, they just make loans. They don't really have the money. And then do a bond issue to back the loan. But what you could do is just make the loans and then sell them off to investors. So what you would be doing is stimulating the economy. You'd be making all kinds of loans that currently aren't available. And
yeah, it sounds like you're turning a state with such great resources, one of the largest economies in the world, from a basket case, a financial basket case, into a financial powerhouse.
To a breadbasket. Yeah.
A bread basket. Oh, very nice. Very nice.
I'll use that. From basket.
Yeah, I like that.
Bread basket.
Well, we'll keep hoping for that and working on it, too. So I appreciate you giving us a check-in on California, because it's an exciting, promising place. And who knows, maybe sometime soon they'll get with the program.
Right.
All right. Thanks, Ellen.
Okay. Thank you.
Time now to check in on what Wall Street costs America. Today, we present the first in a series of background narratives exploring the practices, products, and policies of Wall Street's involvement with America's civic financial well-being. What Wall Street Costs America is a national project being undertaken by the Public Banking Institute, along with a growing number of other civic nonprofit organizations, to share the tales of collusion and collaboration which extract hundreds of billions of dollars from taxpayers every year for the benefit of private interests of banks, hedge funds, and other speculators. With the probable exception of North Dakota, every state and most cities and counties pay handsomely to borrow the money they need to build bridges and schools and to attempt other feats of civic derring-do in an economic environment where tax revenues have dropped and increasing expenses have caused havoc with municipal budgets. What Wall Street costs America is an exploration, a journey perhaps, into various corners of America to see and hear how these tales unfold and what they have cost us, not just in terms of dollars, but also, and perhaps more importantly, in terms of the tolls taken on the residents, the children, business owners, homeowners, and everyone else whose lives have been impacted by the economic malaise of recent years. Also a Wall Street creation. This gathering of stories and data is being assembled and will be available online through a new website that will give geographical access to our assembled materials and is also an opportunity for you to participate with sight and sound contributions. We'll tell you more about that after a bit. But now, let's connect with PBI's Matt Stannard, who has been researching some of these stories for us and spoke with the editor-in-chief of the Maine newspaper in Birmingham, Alabama, about how the Wall Street Shuffle took place in Jefferson County.
Jefferson County filed for a $4.23 billion bankruptcy in 2011. Rolling Stone's Matt Taibbi wrote a devastating account of how Wall Street salesmen and corrupt local officials had connived the county to fund a sewer project with a series of swap deals that essentially pushed the debt into the future, but at geometrically increasing cost. As a result, Jefferson County was crippled by debt. They suffered a downgrade of their credit rating, which is a death blow to municipalities, and have been unable to pay for a lot of general expenditures. Many people say Wall Street broke Jefferson County. Barnett Wright is the executive editor of the Birmingham Times and is someone who has been following the story very closely since its inception. Barnett Wright joins us now. And sir, if you could just tell us what does it look like, or what did it look like from the inside?
Well, it was obvious that Wall Street took advantage of elected officials in Jefferson County at the time. Now, they have since emerged from bankruptcy, but the way that they got there was a devastating account of how Jefferson County knew nothing about swaps. It was very complex. It was very complicated. And very few people knew about how those swaps work, especially in Jefferson County. So what happened was Jefferson County entered into a series of deals of which they had no real knowledge, and they were taken advantage of, and that contributed to the fact that they were unable to repay the money that they borrowed from Wall Street, and they eventually filed for bankruptcy, as you mentioned.
And as this process is going on, tell us, was there a point at which it started to become increasingly obvious to the media and maybe to some conscientious public officials and other citizens that things were not quite right? How did this feeling, or how did this realization, begin to emerge?
Well, especially when the sewer rates kept going up. That was one of the signs that there was a problem, because how do you repay the money that was borrowed from Wall Street? So what we saw was the sewer rates continue to increase in order to repay or to finance those bond deals. And then when you looked at how far into the future, the rates continued to go up exponentially for the residents who were paying the sewer rates. That was a clear understanding that something was wrong.
And was there an attempt, kind of a grassroots attempt or a county-level attempt by some to bring these actors into account and to try to make sense of things? What sort of things were happening at the municipal level as this realization increased?
What happened was the newspapers, the Birmingham News, had some reporters who continued to ask questions, who continued to look at the documents, finding out who was getting paid, beginning to report on a lot of the things that just didn't make sense. For example, the sewer department, the officials in the sewer department, they had their own almost finance department. The county had a finance department looking at all of the expenditures of the county, but the sewer department appeared to have their own particular way of doing finances. So the more the newspapers, the more the reporters looked into that, then there were questions raised about finances, who was paying whom, and that's when we began to see corruption. And that led the arrest or the indictment of charges against many officials in Jefferson County. And I believe that the number is there have been between 20 and 25 people who were charged in one way or another with some type of wrongdoing in Jefferson County in relation to the sewer system, including the former Jefferson County Commission President, Larry Langford, who is currently in prison.
And, of course, the other part of the fallout there is the closure of four courthouses. As you mentioned, massive increase in the cost of various county services, particularly water and sewer rates. There's been other fallout in terms of the loss or degradation of public services there, hasn't there?
Yeah, there were the courthouses did close. There were a number of employees laid off, hundreds of employees. It may have gone into 1,100 people who lost jobs because of the finance. Now, one thing I do want to say is that there was also a problem with the county's occupational tax. They lost their job tax. It was a job tax that brought in about $70 million, which a court ruled was unconstitutional. So they lost their occupational tax, which took a lot of revenue out of the county's general fund. But that was a combination of the problems with the sewer system, with deals that had gone wrong, and the loss of the occupational tax. So it was a marriage of two very bad things that had happened in Jefferson County at the same time.
Now, you had some state officials and some, you know, obviously some so-called fiscal conservatives around the country, they look at a situation like Jefferson County and they don't see the bad Wall Street deals. They just see municipal services that they think can't pay for themselves. And so their solution is, well, just everybody needs to tighten their belts. But it sounds like Jefferson County's tightened their belt about as much as they can.
Jefferson County right now has slimmed down its budget to where it's just bare bones. They have also, as a result of its loss of finances, downsized a county hospital for the poor. Cooper Green Mercy Hospital was established in the early 70s to care for the indigent population in Jefferson County. That is now a clinic. It's no longer a hospital. It's been downsized to a clinic. That was also one of the collateral damage as to what happened in Jefferson County as a result of the belt tightening that you just talked about. So the county-owned hospital for the poor is no longer what it used to be. People have lost jobs. So when you talk about tightening belts, they've done everything that they could have done, and they're operating on a slimmed-down government right now. The road work has seriously been cut back, potholes as far as trimming, the weeds, the roads, the brush on the side of the roads, that's no longer done the way it has been. So the ramifications still exist today in Jefferson County.
Talk about, if you could, the role of the free press and the media in being a watchdog for these kinds of things. As you know better than anyone, print media and local journalism is really struggling around the country, but we really need to have reporters in the media be the watchdogs for this kind of thing, right?
Absolutely, and that goes back to a point I made earlier. As a result of the reporting, a lot of wrongdoing was exposed and uncovered in the Jefferson County Sewer Department. And when you have reporters who will go out there, dig, and shine light to these, then you have things done. Two recent examples, number one, of course, the movie Spotlight won an Oscar for Best Picture, and the Pulitzer Prizes that came out. This shows the importance of reporting, the importance of journalism. And there were some great, great publications that won Pulitzer Prizes, and Spotlight was a great movie.
What else is there to say kind of about maybe the spirit of Jefferson County and the determination to move forward past this? Have there been lessons learned maybe about not trusting Wall Street deals? Has there institutionally or culturally been any kind of changes in terms of how the county wants to go forward?
I think the biggest change was that there was an entirely new body elected to represent Jefferson County. I don't necessarily want to put all the blame on Wall Street. You have to put blame also on the elected officials that you put in office. There are some good deals on Wall Street. There are some good politicians who can be elected. And I think the public, after seeing what had happened in Jefferson County with the corruption, with the wrongdoing, with the indictments, finally settled in on a group of elected officials who they could trust, who they could believe could get the best deals from Wall Street. And I think the lesson learned is that you have to choose your elected officials very, very, very wisely. And the current Jefferson County Commission is the same commission that was elected in 2010. A new group came in 2010. They were all reelected in 2014. That's the first time that has happened in the history of the five-member Jefferson County Commission. And I think what the public saw was that the new group ran on integrity and could be trusted to make the best deals with Jefferson County. And I think that's the biggest lesson learned, is that you have to be careful who you elect in these offices, especially when your government is having financial problems.
Barnett Wright is the executive editor of the Birmingham Times. Barnett, thank you so much for joining us. We appreciate it.
Thank you for talking to me.
Thanks to Barnett Wright and to Matt Stannard for doing this week's report on what Wall Street costs America. You can find out more about the project by coming to the Public Banking Institute website at publicbankinginstitute.org, and you'll find information about how you can participate in building this national story.
My guest today is John McMurtry, University Professor Emeritus at the University of Guelph in Ontario, Canada, and an elected fellow of the Royal Society of Canada. His many articles and books have been internationally published and translated and include multi-volume work for UNESCO's Encyclopedia of Life Support Systems. His latest book is the 2013 edition of The Cancer Stage of Capitalism, From Crisis to Cure. It's great to be talking to you, Professor.
I'm glad to be able to talk to you, Ellen, because I've long admired your work.
And I admire yours.
Thank you.
So in Canada, you're a noted academic, and you usually write for academic audiences, and I want to get to some of that work. But first, I wanted to discuss an article you posted this month that it was written for lay people, and it included some great down-home imagery, which I always appreciate. And your article, to my mind, was right on point. It's called Why the Establishment Hates Trump. Since you're Canadian, you obviously don't have a dog in the race, but you have insightfully picked up on a key issue that Donald Trump threatens what you call the money party, which has controlled U.S. politics and government from both the right and the left for the last century or so. So I thought I'd just read a bit from that article to give the gist of it. The takeaway promised by Trump's policies threatens almost every big lobby now in control of U.S. government purse strings. This understanding keeps our eyes on the ego contest, which is the standard spectacle to avoid the real issues. Trump is preaching a policy revolt against the insatiable corporate jaws feeding on trillions of dollars of public budgets in Washington.
He is on record saying he will cut the Pentagon's budget by 50%. No winning politician has ever dared to take on the military-industrial complex. Trump also says that the U.S. must be neutral, an honest broker, on the Israeli-Palestine conflict, as unspeakable as it gets in U.S. politics. Big Pharma is also called out. The even more powerful HMOs are confronted by the possibility of a one-payer system, the devil incarnate in America's corporate welfare state. Trump even says, wouldn't it be nice to get along with Russia and China for a change? He was also open to nationalizing the Wall Street banks after 2008, et cetera. You go into other things as well. So you write that this is why the establishment on both sides have mounted an attack against Donald Trump. Could you elaborate further on that?
Well, when I say both sides, or do mean that in the sense of both parties, I don't mean both sides in the sense of left and right, for example, although it's quite amazing really how the left has bought into what is really a media storm to denounce and invalidate Trump. And what prompted me to write this article was the fact that nobody mentioned these policies that he was proposing. In fact, I had to find them separately. No one was joining the dots. No one was mentioning the policy in any of the media I could see. None of them, including left media. And so I had to independently research every one of these. And when you go over them, it's quite amazing that no one would mention about Trump. Nobody has mentioned them in together, joined the dots between them. What is always being done is that we never have a policy examination when we get into U.S. politics or Canadian politics, not quite as bad because the money isn't quite so dominant, but they never deal with the policy, but rather they make it an ego contest, and they make it as they do elsewhere at war and so forth. There's good guys and bad guys, and that's all we really deal with, one scandal story after the next. Where we look at the actual policy, though, he says, and now William Greeter has discovered this too, that he regards it as shutting the Pentagon down. So you find certain people pointing out that this is a very big issue. His own term is lowering it by 50%. Who on either side anywhere has ever suggested or proposed reducing the Pentagon budget by 50%? Well, some have, progressives have, but it's never been in the mass media, and this is never mentioned. It's huge, and both sides just ignore that altogether. Even Bernie Sanders, who is a progressive candidate, the hit on Bernie Sanders from the progressive media is that he has gone along with the Pentagon all along. He's gone along with the corporate feeding station of the Pentagon that just has huge, 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 well, it's almost $2 billion a day when you count everything in. Anyway, that's who's against that? Who's actually publicly opposed that? Only very progressive people who are not in the mass media at all would propose that. And then when we look at what you just said, that you know, the idea of being neutral and an honest broker in the Israeli-Palestine dispute. Well, I mean, that is unspeakable. Whoever mentions that we should be more even-handed with Israel and Palestine on either side, it's sort of an unspeakable subject. There's a very, very powerful lobby. It has many different forms, and some say that lobby even indeed runs foreign affairs of the U.S. covert state itself. So whoever takes on Israel as not being even-handed with Palestine. Well, in fact, what Israel is, and as I've said this to some people, it's an ongoing war crime. Everything it's doing and instituting, almost everything that we see, is a war crime under international law. Well, at least he gets into saying, well, let's at least be even-handed here. And he's right, but who mentions that on either side about Israel possibly being, you know, that we're being biased, not only biased, but, you know, it's a kind of axis of evil in the Middle East. It seems to behave that way. So that was an unspeakable. That one of the ones that you didn't mention is that he also asks for an examination of the 9/11 causation. Like, he understands that the official conspiracy theory is not plausible and there's something more to it. Well, that's also unspeakable, and it links to Israel because a lot of people think Israel was involved in the execution of that destruction of the World Trade buildings. So that is an unspeakable. So another one you mentioned was the big pharma is called out. Well, who calls big pharma out? Who criticizes it in this way? He's saying, well, we've got to have a public negotiation of prices that apply for all American citizens through public programs and otherwise. And that's just been, I've observed for years, that's been unspeakable on the public stage. No one really mentions it because why? Big Pharma has huge contributions and one of their biggest recipients is Hillary Clinton. Now, Hillary Clinton is said to be critical of Big Pharma, too, but she nevertheless receives hundreds of thousands of dollars right now from Big Pharma for her campaign. So taking on Big Pharma in that way, and in a very serious way, not just saying, oh, we've got to do something and make sure the prices are fair, etc., but rather negotiating the price. This is the whole key to American politics, is that you have no public option there. And that's the key thing that has always saved America and always saves everybody else, too, everywhere around the world, is a public option for the things that the people are being exploited and ruined, really, by private profit systems that have no productive function, but really want to, where you want to have a monopoly condition where they can charge whatever prices they want, which, you know, they charge prices that are even higher than Canada, though Canada, too, has been controlled by Big Pharma. But even bigger there, which you also mentioned, the HMOs are the health medical organizations, the maintenance organizations. They are, again, it's the public option that he is recommending. Well, you don't find that ever reported. He is recommending that, and that public option, in fact, he was denounced as not a Republican at all because he did recommend the public option. And the public option, the one-payer system, is a huge, I mean, there's hundreds of billions of dollars involved there. That's why it was fought not only by the pharmacy, but of course the health maintenance organizations fought so hard in the past that even when the medical associations themselves were coming out in favor of a one-payer option, it's got destroyed by, the propaganda apparatus of big money and especially HMO and big pharma. Well, you see the common quality here, the common thread, is that every one of these is over public money. And every one of them is over public money being misspent. Every one of them, in fact, he thinks it's a kind of a robbery of public money. And in that respect, he's right. And that's why everybody who has said nothing about any of these things is wants to see the end of Trump. But we're not finished yet. And one of the things you don't mention there, it may be maybe the one that's most provocative, is he's against these international trade agreements, which are, as you know, are just basically imposed secretly, corporately minted, and held in secret forms of control that have thousands of regulation to protect one thing alone, and that is transnational corporate profits. And he said that that trade system is wrong, that he wants to see, because it's the thing that's ruined the American working class, because they produce these commodities offshore at whatever the bottom floor of labor price is, which will be a tenth of the U.S., and then they bring it back under these trade treaties, which are really trade fiats, dictates, because no one really has anything to do with them except the transnational corporations. But they're allowed to import their goods back in duty-free, and that has ruined the manufacturing base of the U.S., also Canada, by the way. But in the U.S., it's even more dramatic. And his coming out and saying, I'm going to end these trade agreements. I mean, they just can't. This is almost another unspeakable. But it's going to receive a lot of support from the blue-collar people of America. And again, you see that the public interest, the common public interest, is coming out here again. They can't go on doing this and ruining everybody's lives in the tens of millions, which is what has happened. They've been reduced to almost third world conditions in order to compete with labor prices abroad or be disemployed, unemployed, work at a fraction of the salary with no benefits and so forth. So that's a huge one. That and the one about getting along with Russia and China and winding down these wars, which and where America has been involved in wars of aggression that have ruined it. They've cost $3 trillion of public money, and they've committed an eco-genocide of Iraq, and you have that complete destruction occurring. And he's saying, pull out. You shouldn't have gotten into these wars to begin with. I mean, he's not against the armed empire abroad, but he's against wars of aggression as too costly. I mean, this is a minimalist stand, but it's a stand that's not being given by others. And then when he says, why don't we get along with Russia and China? And that enemy cornerstone of U.S. ideology, there's always an enemy. There doesn't really seem to be a positive U.S. ideology, certainly not one of the public interest and the common interest. It always seems to be motivated by this is evil, this is bad, and we're going to attack it, as if you're winding back to the preconscious era of the original settlements and so forth. Is this always the enemy is what motivates and generates the actions and the wars, and in this case, the attack on Trump himself as an internal person who's threatening all these money interests. If you take out the enemy cornerstone of U.S. ideology, what is left? What is left is something you stand for in the world other than going after the latest designated enemy. And that is, I think, the ultimate ideological operation that continues to sustain the U.S. as a war-making empire that's just continuing a full-spectrum dominance policy, which is bipartisan and across the world and really never lets up. It's just always moving forward, just keeps moving towards Russia's border, and it wants to go through Russia's border. In fact, that's planned, if it can do it, and keep proceeding east. So when you challenge the enemy cornerstone of U.S. imperial ideology and, I would say, the very identity, the public identity that's promoted by the media, then you are going after very innards, the very inner mechanism of the great cancer system, as I diagnose it. It's not an image, it's a macro diagnosis of the system. And so in these ways, whatever Trump's other behaviors, which have been much vilified, what I was interested in is why do they hate him so much? He seems to be an exemplar of the American way, as they say, Reagan on steroids.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you've written a lot about the role of the media, and it does seem to me that in the last century, in the 19th century, we actually had reporters who went out and did independent reporting and criticized things, but for at least the last century, we've had a media that's been owned and controlled by big money and what you call the money party.
Yeah.
So it doesn't matter whether it's the Democrats or the Republicans. I mean, we have a two-party system. We never get a third party in. There hasn't been a third party in since Abraham Lincoln. He was actually a third-party candidate at the time. You know, it was a new party.
But you're right. The media have just been taken. Advertising vehicles which sell media spaces to the wealthiest corporations. And they're structured as a propaganda tool to sell. And not only sell commodities, but sell the system. And by the way, I've written, as you have, for all the major, all the ones in Canada and a lot of the world, major media, I have been published in, but I always know when I do it that I'm going to be sensitive if anything I say conflicts with what the dominant story, the dominant narrative is, and especially if it conflicts with the money party's interests. It just will not get in. For example, it's a nice example because I really did it as almost an experimental site. When the war drums were beating for invading Iraq for false reasons, I started writing the major newspapers, just the short, and I know how to put it as so that it's publicly appealing because I've been a professional journalist, and just say basically that if the U.S. attacks Iraq, invades Iraq, it'll be the supreme crime under international law. I mean, that's really what it is called in the international law, the supreme crime of a war of aggression, because in it are involved all the other crimes. And just put it very simply, just as a fact that they should be aware of, because no one was saying it. No one ever mentioned it. Even now it's not said much. But it wasn't until after it had already happened that any whisper of that would ever come out in the media. So that's the way it operates all the time. Anything that contradicts the money interests, the transnational money interests, and thus the full spectrum power, then it will be selected out. This isn't the way the media has always been. There used to be autonomous media in the city, and they used to compete against each other, and investigative reporters were an icon and a hero of the society, and now we have almost none of that. We just really have advertising milk cows that bring in revenues, and the idea of actually presenting something that's true or important to our common life interests, that is just ruled out by the very mechanisms of reproduction and reporting.
Mm-hmm. Now, we do have the alternative media, which I think is where we're getting our breakthrough. Most voters get their news from TV. TV is where the control point is. But I think, hopefully, that we are breaking through, particularly with the 2008 economic collapse, and then there was the official story that you had to let the government and the big banks take over, save the big banks, and that would fix it, and it obviously didn't fix it. So most people are suffering, and so they've become quite jaded to the party line on those things. So
well,
I think
indeed,
that's why we're seeing
a
growing
change.
Police state, too, because that's their only means of control is by force, because they can't do it anymore by...
Right. That's what it is, and the trade agreements themselves are by force. You know, it's all secret, and then it's enforced by NATO. But that's the way downstream. But before that, by international embargo, that's how they have broken Argentina's leadership, its progressive leadership, is by allowing the vulture banks being able to collect the full amount of original loans that they have paid 1 cent on the dollar for, and they're breaking the Bank of Argentina as well as doing all those sorts of other things, joining with the media there, and that's a real problem in Latin America, is the media are all owned by oligarchic interests. So you have insult, abuse, discrediting, demonization going on from the media at the same time as there's people being armed in the streets and making life ungovernable. And then you have the police who behave criminally. I mean, it's criminal assault that is their natural and formal way of dealing with things continuously. And so they can't do it any other way now by force. And how true that is, and on many levels, there's force used. You can't get into the media that are doing this. You can't get into the police or the army that are doing this. You can't, you know, and it's just sort of one step after another that there is no alternative. Indeed, that's been the slogan for the New World Order. No alternative.
Mm-hmm.
That means you've got to force it.
So besides that article, which I thought was great, I wanted to talk a bit about your latest book, or actually it's an update of an earlier book called The Cancer Stage of Capitalism, From Crisis to Cure. There was an article on Global Research, basically on subject of your book, and it was called Is There a Unifying Alternative to the Empire of Chaos? You write in your book that what we're missing in our economic theories and practice today is a grounding life value base. What we're missing is life capital, or the concept of life capital.
What I define it as is basically finding what's actually already in operation all over the place, but we don't know it. It's preconscious. It's not yet been made conscious. It's life capital, is life wealth or capacities. And this is part of my work in value theory and so forth, that all value in the world on this planet, on Earth, is life value. There is no other value, and we haven't recognized that either. But life value itself, well, what is that? Well, that's what enables life capacities of all sorts, capacities of all other species, ourselves, whether we're talking about our cognitive capacities or physical fitness or whatever. And it all can be measured, every one of those life capacities. So any life, any value is life value. So life capital is life wealth or capacity that produces more life wealth or capacities through time without loss and with cumulative gain. Economics, that's what it should be producing, is life goods that are otherwise in short supply. And that's the way capitalism started. I mean, it actually produced life goods. Unlike now, where we really don't have any life goods being produced. Even our food has been debased to the extent that it's causing obesity and cancer and all kinds of other diseases. It's disease-causing substances that make a profit. So what we've got to do is move back to the original idea of the economy, which is producing life goods otherwise in short supply, and life capital is how you do it. Life capital is everything that is required to do it. That's what we should keep our eye on. We haven't even understood this yet, because the economics that has been dominant since Adam Smith, you know, it's a price system. It's a produce for exchange for money, and you do it for a profit in the dominant forms of production, and that's what capitalism has turned out to be. And we just lost that. We just got more and more tied up with, as you know, put it simply, the money party, wanting to go money sequences, turning money into more money without necessarily producing any use value at all. That's been really the revolution of the last century, is not producing any life value at all, and that's where finance capital comes in, is it just keeps making more and more money. It has exponential processes of multiplication of itself as money demand without producing any life good, but destroying them life-blindly all the time. So we have to reground on all the levels, as we already are doing. Families are already doing it, in a sense, with their kids, if they're conscientious. They're saying, well, we got to have good food for our kids, and that means we've got to shop carefully. That means we got to read labels. That means we've got to ensure we have a balanced diet and so forth. So there, you might say everything that a good parent is doing in an upbringing that is working, everything can be understood in life capital terms. It can be quantified. You know, you need so much protein, you need so much calories and so forth. It can be quantified to the finest detail you want. Then medicine will be another form of life capital analysis that doesn't understand itself as that, but that's what it is that it's always looking to see, you know, it's always some life capacity breaks down somehow. Things go wrong there, and we have to have an intervention. Now, a lot of times that intervention won't really be doing any good, and increasingly with the big pharma and so forth that just sell drugs that deal with the symptom for a brief time and then end up in bigger problems. But if we're really doing medicine, in the Hippocratic Oath sense of medicine, we're making the life capacities of a person that are somehow failing or breaking down in whatever regard, whether it's a pneumonia or a cold or a broken leg or whatever, and we're trying to restore that life capacity always.
I know somebody who's had a cure for, you know, a simple, cheap cure for a disease, and went to a pharmaceutical company, and they said, well, that's an interesting concept, but you know we're not going to make it. And he said, why not? And he said, well, because, you know, we can't make any money off that.
That's right.
They're making their money off disease. If they get rid of the disease, they've gotten rid of their
market. So they're really producing, and that's where you get into the cancer model as the only way really of understanding what is happening here. They're just multiplying their money demand on the life world and life capacities in order to squeeze profits out of it. And since it's a life-blind process, it's only concerned with maximizing the money returns to itself exponentially, then it just runs through everything, multiplying itself and having no regard for and no requirement to, which should be built into the economy itself, to make it for a life good. If you cannot patent it as a monopoly and charge a price for it, it may be the best cure in the world, but we're not going to touch it. So this is predictable. That guy's response was predictable from the way the system operates. Well, if it's always multiplying its money take and always consuming, depredating, or in other ways using, exploiting life capacities at every level of terrestrial life organization, well, isn't that the way a cancer behaves, where it keeps multiplying itself and then keeps metastasizing from one site to another?
Yeah,
they're all there.
Yeah, you had written that the media should be the immune system, which should be preventing attack, but it's not, because it's obscuring what the attacker is, actually.
Well, in fact, it's promoting the attacker, because always is a money seeker. I think that if you go down to the common cause of all the various pathological phenomena and invasions, these days it's transnational money sequencing to more money and just going through life hosts and ecological, organic, social, economic life hosts, just eating them up to maximize and multiply its profits. And then you see all of a sudden things start to break down all over the place. Right? What level of life organization isn't being invaded, isn't at risk, and the species are in an extinction spasm?
I want to get to your subtitle is From Crisis to Cure. So I wanted to get to what your cure is or how you would change the system. And I know public banking is one of your solutions, so I don't want to miss that topic.
Right. Well, you know, I could say that the solution to all of it is life capital understanding and application so that life capital is protected rather than destroyed. And the main way you do that, you begin with the banking, which, you know, is your expertise. You begin with public banking as, I think, the ultimate necessary basis of any working economy. And I would even argue, and you probably would agree, that the only economy that works is one that does have public banking or the equivalent to public banking. You know, Japanese may not have a state-owned bank, but the Ministry of the Economy invests. Problem isn't a big issue because its creditors are its own people. So it ends up being a kind of public banking. China has had its tremendous success going from centuries ago to an industrial economy that leads the world by public banking. And by the way, Russia did the same thing before as the Soviet Union. Or Lincoln, that was the only way he won the Civil War. And you go on and on. Canada, well, you've already, I think you've talked to Paul Hillier, who is a minister of the Crown here, and knows from firsthand that we had public banking through our central bank, the Bank of Canada, that was able to lend to the government at its own rate, which was basically no interest or no service charges. And that's when most of the infrastructure of Canada was built. I think that there's a lot of this in the New Deal, too, that you had public banking, public spending. That's the key. But the public spending can't be wasteful. Greenwash, I mean, that's a huge one. Trillions are going into greenwash projects that don't work. So you have to have a life capital criterion. Are they producing a life good without which life will be destroyed in degrees or all at once? If we're not producing a life good, then we're not going to invest in it. So once you get the public bank idea that it's public money that is the real basis of having an economy that is healthy, and we know that already historically, then we have a criterion of all public investment. So it rules out armaments and all kinds of things. If the public investment isn't in life capital, and life capital such as education, life capital such as healthcare, life capital such as our sidewalks and means of communication, and on you go. It includes everything that's worthwhile. But if it isn't for that, then it shouldn't happen. That should be the criterion of it. You're investing in life, and you're investing life capital, that is, which produces and reproduces and cumulatively gains through generational time. It'll all end up being that kind of thing, which begins with public banking. And I think we're probably in agreement on that.
Yeah, oh, that's great. I've been speaking with John McMurtry, University Professor Emeritus at the University of Guelph, Ontario, Canada, and the author of many books. The latest of his books is The Cancer Stage of Capitalism, From Crisis to Cure.
Well, that's it for this week's edition of It's Our Money with Ellen Brown. Our thanks to our guests and to our sponsor, Payment Management, a merchant payment processing company dedicated to economic fairness and justice. Payment Management invites you to receive a free analysis of your card processing needs and costs. More information is available at paymentmgmt.com. Be sure to stay in touch with the ongoing conversations around what's going on in our world of money by reading Ellen's blog at ellenbrown.com. And to learn more about public banking and how you can participate, visit publicbankinginstitute.org. Thanks for listening. For Ellen Brown, I'm Walt McCree. See you next time on It's Our Money with Ellen Brown.